super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake, mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Okay, we are 2 days before Halloween, and I said that I was going to have the scariest man in America on tonight's show. And that man isn't Freddy Krueger, and that man isn't Michael Myers. But let me segue for a couple seconds, because back in 1982, I was at a place called Passaic Book Center going through the used book section, and I found this book put out by Ballantine. It has a black cover with raised black letters that say off-season with a drop of blood dripping down. And on the back it says, a beautiful New York editor retreats to a quiet Maine beach town. Nearby, a savage human family lurks in the woods, watching, waiting. And before too many hours pass, five civilized, sophisticated people will learn just how primitive we all are and that there are no limits to the will to survive. And I took this book home, I read it, and it scared the shit out of me. And I'm real happy to have, for my guest tonight, author Jack Ketchum. Welcome to the show, Jack. Thanks for scaring the crap out of me back in 82. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, I remember something you had told me about this book that, and I know the Village Voice crapped all over it, said it was violent pornography and things like that, but I think you had told me that the company made you tone it down a bit in its first go-around?
Sure. Ballantine said, look, okay. They were really happy with this because they thought they'd never seen a book with this many teeth before. But on the other hand, they wanted to tone it down. They felt it was like a little too extreme. Plus, the main thing for me was at the end of the book, I do a kind of a Night of Living Dead kind of thing with, and it's a spoiler, but I got to say it. One of the main characters who's gone through hell to sort of rescue his lady friend, who's not even his girlfriend. Goes through all this stuff, and he's killed a la Night of the Living Dead by friendly fire. They couldn't deal with that at all. It completely messed their brains up, and I said, look, this makes sense. This is the whole point is, you know, you're never, just because you're a hero doesn't mean you're invulnerable. Well, they wouldn't let me do that. So I changed it because I was a first book writer, and I was scared I was never going to get the damn thing published at all. And then when I got another contract to do another version of the book, I put it right back in because that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I just picked up that version and I'm actually afraid to read it right about now.
Oh, you'll like it, Pete, because there's actually, they also made me cut some recipes for humans as cuisine, and I put those back in too.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, a little cuisine. I'm always into like a barbecue myself.
These things are interesting, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I admitted it live one night that I said that I really have to psych myself up to read anything you write.
Good.
Because I never know what I'm getting into. I've read Stephen King, and, you know, you may basically make him look like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Well, I wouldn't say that Stephen's exactly a kinder and gentler nation, but Stephen's got a real sweet side to him. And,
oh, I know. Yeah, I know. He puts you over all the time, too.
Yeah, yeah. It comes definitely through in his work, and as a person, he's a great guy. So, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and like I say, you're one of the guys, sort of like me, that where you lead people to expect the worst, and you give it to them. No problem.
I try.
Yeah.
It's funny, because just now I just read a review of The Woman in The Village Voice, and I cannot get The Village Voice on my team. They just don't like my shit. The New York Times did. Again, they liked The Woman. The Post did, and so did the Wall Street Journal. But I cannot get the Village Voice. They just, you know, they just don't like my stuff. And I don't really mind, because this is as pretentious a review as the first one was.
Yeah, and like there's no such thing as bad publicity. And no. For those listeners who don't know, The Woman is the third in what became a trilogy. I don't know if it was supposed to end up that way, but
it happened that way. It wasn't really my idea in the first place, but I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, because you followed it up with Offspring, which was equally as brutal as Off-Season. And then I just finished Woman last night, and I'm like, holy shit, dude, you just left it wide open for a fourth one.
Well, yeah. That's because it was conceived as a movie and a book at the same time. Yeah. And we just were so fascinated by the character of the woman, and actually, in particular, Pollyanna McIntosh, who plays her in Offspring, and then really the woman is her movie, that we just we left it open-ended. Whether we do another a sequel or something, I don't know really well whether we'll do it yet, because the woman has got a lot on its mind, and it's I think it's got some gravitas, and we want to try to find the same kind of idea if we do a sequel, it's got to be that kind of thing. It can't just be another Friday the 13th ripoff. So we have to sort of figure that out, where we can take that new family that she is dealing with at the end of the film, and anywhere. We'll see.
I know. It's incredible because she just became such a strong character, and, you know, initially from, like, Offspring and stuff like that, you're supposed to despise her, but at the end of Woman, you're, like, cheering for her.
Well, the end of Offspring, the thing about Offspring is she's just ferocious. And she's so ferocious, that's why we just said, oh, my God, she deserves a movie all to herself. But what we knew we had to do was to give her lots more range, lots more emotional range, so that she can not just display ferociousness, but caring, pain, happiness, a larger canvas. And we found a way to do that, and I think that's what we need to do if we're going to do a sequel, is keep the canvas big.
Oh yeah, she's incredible, and I haven't seen Woman yet because I guess it only had a brief theatrical deal, and it's supposed to be coming out on DVD, I believe, January.
I don't know what the DVD thing is, but it's had a reasonable run in the theaters in selected cities. It got held over for a week here in New York, which is really nice, but there were only a few cities. We'll see. I think they're probably going to try to do a television before they try DVD.
So, oh, you mean cable, you mean?
Yeah. Well, cable, horror channel, that sort of thing. I have no idea. That distribution is really not my area. I leave that to the
case. Yeah, I just saw on Amazon they have a release date of January 2012.
Interesting, okay.
They're taking pre-orders on it now, so.
That's news to me. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's all good. I mean, you know, if anybody deserves it, you do. I mean, you know, you've had very few adaptations into film until recently, you know, with The Lost and Red and The Girl Next Door and now this. So it's all good.
It's all very good. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
And plus, I don't know if the fans know about this. There was an incident when you guys had screened this where somebody completely went batshit and said the film should be burned and made a complete scene and probably made an asshole out of himself in general.
Oh, that was wonderful. That was Sundance. That was wonderful.
It was Sundance. Oh, wow.
You couldn't have asked for a better controversy. This guy, evidently, I wasn't there, but Lucky was there. He was going to introduce the movie and then do a Q&A afterwards. Lucky McKee, who's the director and co-writer, and the producer was there with the guy who was going to do a recording of the Q&A once the film was done. Well, before it was finished shooting, this guy stood up and he started screaming, I guess, and yelling about how this was it exploited men, women, I don't know, children, whatever, and how dare Sundance even book it, and all these prints should be picked up and burned. And they escorted him out of the theater, which is pretty unusual for Sundance. Evidently, they're pretty laissez-faire there. And Andrew, who was sitting with the guy who was supposed to be photographing Lucky's Q&A, said, screw the Q&A, go outside, just see what this guy is doing. And he was ranting and raving to the bouncer who threw him out, and one of the guys from Sundance, and he went on for about 5 minutes. Well, it was all on camera, so it went viral. And in the first day, I think it hit 30,000 hits, and by the end of the first week, it was 100,000 hits. So this guy was fabulous, you know.
Yeah, no, I saw it. Okay. I'm looking at this guy. He's almost foaming at the mouth. This film has to be burned. The people who did it should be shot. This and then the other thing. I'm like, this is cool shit. You know, this is great.
Yes. And the interesting thing is, demented as he is, he's also fairly articulate. So it wasn't as though he was just like some, you know, crazy, strange redneck weirdo. He was just really offended and very articulate about it, which was great.
Didn't he have his wife with him too?
he had people with him. Who they were, I don't really know. I know that you could sort of look at them and say, well, they weren't poor. They had some money. Yeah. Even one of the women had a rap.
I tell you, like, you can't buy publicity like that. It probably pushed sales of the book, I would think, too. People would want to read something like that or want to see what it's all about.
Well, I think it sort of cross pollinates. You know, the book, the movie, interest in foreign interest, because that's the wonderful thing about the net. You know, this is our little mini revolution. We're not exactly, we're not exactly in the Mideast, but it's our little revolution. We've got our little airtime of revolution.
Yeah, and like I say, you can't buy publicity like that.
A lot of people thought it was bought, but it really wasn't. Andrew, when I first saw it, I called Andrew and I said, "Did you set this up?" Because he's clever, he could have.
Yeah.
No, this was completely spontaneous. This guy just did us a favor.
Yeah, it's almost harkens back to, remember when snuff was running into the city and somebody hired picketers to go out there and do stuff, and then they called him up and he goes, "Well, I'm not saying I did, but I'm not going to say I didn't."
Yeah, but that was the producers. That was, I think, Roberta Findlay.
They had filmed it, but I think the guy who was ballyhooing it was a guy named Shackleton.
Okay.
Yeah, or somebody like that. It was he had bought the stuff off the Findlays because it was basically unwatchable, was unfinished, and he tacked on that crappy little ending that they shot in Carter Stevens' studio.
Some Argentina or someplace, right?
Yeah. They went down there, they shot this thing. It was supposed to be like a Manson-type film, and
right.
It's fucking horrible. It's incoherent, you know?
They shot 1.5 hour, I believe, or maybe 15 minutes. That was definitely different footage, and you could see that it was different footage, but it was scary. So I was there in the theater first run, and if you went there, you had this sort of existential moment where, my God, am I really going to see a real snuff film? Because that's the way they positioned it. That's the way they booked it.
Right.
And I remember when the film cut, and you could tell that we were now dealing with new film, the woman who stepped into frame was a slim, blonde woman with short hair. She looked a fuck of a lot like a woman I actually knew, who I had years ago had a small affair with, and I could only see her from the back and the side, but she looked so familiar that for a moment, just for a moment, I thought, my God, what if it's her, and what if they're going to kill her? Heart and throat time. Utter heart and the throat time. I don't think I've ever been so stranged out by a film. Of course, then once you get into it, within 2 minutes you realize that it's fake. But at that moment I just thought, oh my God, what have I paid for? I mean, have I paid to see someone I actually know being murdered? My, what an existential moment that was. It was so much an existential moment that I wrote about it in a short story called Mail Order, which has been made into a short film recently.
I vaguely remember reading about that. Yeah, but I remember the whole scene was when they cut off her hand and her fingers were still moving. I'm sitting there going, yeah, okay, you know.
Pete was showing her age.
Yep, I know. Oh, you know, speaking about that, I'm not going to give away either one of our ages, but, you know, for people who don't know, Jack and I grew up almost next to each other. I'm from West Orange. He's from Livingston. And Carter Stevens actually is from West Orange, too. So somebody goes, what the hell is in the water with you guys up there? But correct me on this. Your parents had a luncheonette sweet shop called the Sugar Bowl that was in Livingston Circle, and I think it was near the Colony Theater.
Actually, no, it was midway between Northfield Circle and Livingston Circle, which was in fact almost directly midway. It was a old-fashioned confectionery store, which meant that it not only was a luncheonette. It sold newspapers, magazines, books, Band-Aids, Wonder Bread, pretty much soda, almost everything. It was a small, small little store, but it was kind of like a bodega. What we would, think of now in later years is a bodega. It had a little bit of everything. Batteries, cigars. And so I worked there. I grew up working there. My first job was bundling up the Newark Star-Ledger and sending it back on Monday morning after the Sunday edition had closed.
I can remember buying magazines in there when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I think because I was a reader early on, I got to control the magazine racks and the book racks and the comic book racks really early. I put the faces out of the magazines and the books that I thought were going to sell, and I was good at it. And so that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Famous Monsters of Filmland. I remember.
Yeah, right. That's why I went up there to buy monster magazines.
I remember putting the first ever edition of Famous Monsters of Filmland on the rack. It was in the first rack. This is so cool. And I can still remember, it's like this guy in a Frankenstein mask. It's green.
Yeah, holding a girl. Standing next to a
blonde girl. And the background is red. I still remember that cover.
And people don't know that. That was taboo back in the day, too.
Damn, yeah.
Yeah. I went to Catholic school, and they ripped the stuff up in front of me, you know?
They would come in, the same distributor who brought in Famous Monsters brought in all the men's mags. Brought in, like, Man's Action and all that stuff. Yep.
Yeah, we didn't have too much porn back then. I think just Playboy, that was it. If you want to even call that porn, you know, early.
Playboy was the extreme at that point. But what you had was mostly, you had, like, men's magazines, which would have stories. They'd have the woman with the cannibal gods and stuff like that. And then they'd have, like, sequences where they'd have strippers like Lily Sincere and Belle Starr. And there would be black and white shots, never nude, usually pasties. And that's about it. God, we're showing our age.
Yeah, I know. Those are like pulp adventures. They used to have Nazis on the covers and shit and hip. Scantily clad women being abused by the evil Japanese conquerors and the Nazis and all kinds of other great stuff.
Yeah. Really good pulp craziness, yeah.
Yeah, we are showing our age, damn.
But you know what? Those are fun days.
We had a lot of fun. I mean, hell, how many times have we run into each other over the years? I mean, you were down doing a book signing right next to me down, I think it was Horror Find in Baltimore. And on a Friday night, you turn around to me and you go, "I think I'm having a stroke." And I go, "Why?" You go, look at my hand. It's all curled up. I go, "Dude, you've been signing books for like 5 hours straight. Your hand's going to curl up." And you basically sold out of stuff that Friday night. You had to get more stuff shipped in.
I remember exactly what that was. There was a mass signing.
Yeah.
And there's a long line of us signing stuff. And the crowd was wonderful. They just kept on coming and coming and coming. And all of a sudden, my thumb cramped up. And I tried to lift it with my other hand, and it just cramped up again. And it was like trying to pick up a staple. It didn't work. Finally, this one lovely woman came up to me and said, "I can fix that." And she sort of took my hand and she massaged it. So, but I never tried to sign another book after that.
You were pretty much shot after that, because you just looked at me with this expression on your face, and you go, "Pete, I think I'm having a stroke."
You've never had me before. What the fuck is that all about?
Yeah. That was a fun show.
It was a fun show.
And the other one we ran into each other at, we didn't even know we were there, was that Eroticon in New York at the Javits Center that got under Giuliani's nose.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. A friend of mine was sort of partially running that, and I think I was the only actual author there. It was all people.
I wandered over there. I don't know what I was doing, and I ran into you. And, "Oh, what are you doing here?" I go, "I'm working with Liquidators over there. We're selling tapes." "Ah, come on back and have a drink." So I think I had a couple scotches with you, and on an empty stomach, I was completely lit up by the time I got back, and I started selling my ass off, and Norman looked at me, and he goes, "You know, if I knew that's all it would have taken, I would have brought a bottle with us."
Absolutely. Next time,
yeah. That was a lot of fun. And then, you know, we just bumped into each other at Horror Realm out in Pittsburgh about a month ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen you for quite a while.
Yeah, that was a really good experience. I hadn't seen Tiffany in a few years, too. I think the last time I saw you guys was at Rock and Shock.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're still going. You know, it's like, and there's a few other things that, like, I forgot that slipped through the cracks. You also did a book called Ladies' Night.
Yeah.
Which I haven't seen around in a while, but I have a copy of it. And if anybody doesn't know what that is, it's sort of like, I'd say, Night of the Living Dead female style.
Well, the premise is,
it's one
night in New York because of a chemical spill. Every woman in the city goes completely berserk. And it's sexual violence. And it's like, my tagline, I wrote a screenplay based on it some years ago. And everybody in Hollywood wants a tagline. They want the sky hook that they can they can sort of hang the entire notion on, so that they can sell it to distributors, investors, or whatever. And my skyhook for that was, in the war between men and women, the shooting has begun. And that kind of worked.
Yeah.
Interesting thing about Ladies' Night, and I don't want to, screw the pooch here, but Ladies' Night for a long time was optioned by Stuart Gordon, Reanimator, et cetera, et cetera. And Stuart and I talked about doing it in different ways. He wanted to shoot it in New York. I think that's real expensive to shoot a movie like that in New York. And he hasn't had really a lot of luck with it. But just recently I've been talking to another producer who may want to do the damn thing and put it out in the burbs, make it a little cheaper to shoot. So it's not impossible. You might see an actual film of Ladies' Night somewhere around that. That book has just stuck around. When I first wrote it, it was my second novel. It was originally called The Mantis Syndrome. And I wrote it huge because Ballantyne wanted it huge. I wrote about 400 pages. I had subplots about the government, about the military, about scientists, about a gay friend of my protagonist's. I had all this stuff. It had elephantitis. It was huge. Well, it never got sold because by then the shit had hit the fan about off season. It's like, my God, this is violent pornography. We don't want anything to do with it. So I never did get to sell that version. Years later, I came back and I cut the hell out of it and found a small, really neat little book in it, sort of like around the same page level as Off-Season. And it was sort of a sister book to Off-Season. And it's been published lots of times here and abroad, and it's had good legs. It could actually be a movie someday. We'll see.
Is it still in print? Because I haven't seen it anywhere.
Yeah, Gauntlet Press. Has an edition out. It's a paperback, it's a, trade paper. You can get it.
Yeah, well, I got the original copy that you had when you had them back in the day.
Yeah. Yep. Barry has kept almost all my stuff in print. Everything I sold to him is still in print.
Yeah, now...
That's Gauntlet. That's Gauntlet has done Ladies' Night, Right to Life. Let's see, what else? Only Child. They've been good.
Yeah. Now, what's the story with Off Season? It seems like that would have been like one hell of a movie, and you had said that somebody picked up the options but never did anything with it.
Well, they picked up the options. They actually bought it. That had been optioned many times. I would say maybe five or six times before this gentleman came along who actually paid me the full price for it. So I was basically used to taking the option money and saying, all right, it's not going to make the movie. It's done. But this one company came together and they actually bought it. I accepted the check. And then they just never had the money to actually make it. As it stands right now, that's never been filmed. Again, there's a possibility because we're in negotiations with the person who bought the original rights to possibly release them and do a film. So we'll see. That could be in the burner too.
Yeah. How do you think that would work as a film though? Because I mean, it's sort of like almost like The Hills Have Eyes on crack, you know?
Yeah. Well, I won't say who's involved, but he's really a good, well-respected filmmaker. And his response was, he just reread it and he said, this really still has complete legs. You don't really have to add anything to it. The Hills Have Eyes came out around the same time that my book did.
Yeah.
There was something in the air about cannibals. I don't know. But it's different. It still holds up pretty well. And I think you could simply photograph it pretty much the way it was written because it's sort of cinematic in the first place. And that's what this particular filmmaker wants to do if we get to do it. Do it with a lot of attention to the source material.
Yeah, it's a very visceral book, and I picked up Off Season the DVD from you when I was met you at Rockin' Shock, and that one is really, really very close to what you wrote.
In Offspring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. I've been really lucky in each of the books that have been filmed have paid a lot of attention to the source material with varying degrees of success, but for the most part, all these people have not, they haven't thrown out the baby with the bathwater once, which is what a lot of novelists sort of almost expect. You know, Hollywood's going to fuck your movie up, your book up. Nobody has. I'm happy with each of the movies to varying degrees, and with in some cases, really happy. So.
Yeah, and like a lot of people say, you don't go to traditional route with as many horror writers do. There's no werewolves or vampires and stuff. It's basically ordinary people who are pretty fucked up. You know?
Yeah, well ordinary people are the ones who fuck me up. They're the ones who scare me.
I
love a really good occult novel or a really good. I like one of my favorite novels of all time is Ghost Story, and maybe my favorite Stephen King is still The Shining. I don't know. There's lots of stuff in either of those guys' pockets. They're wonderful, but I love that stuff. What it really grabs me, but it doesn't really. That's not what really scares me. So if I'm going to scare you, I want to scare myself first. It's like if I want to turn you on, I got to turn myself on first. Make you fall in love, make you cry. I got to cry a little. Yeah. So what I try to do is go for what really frightens me, and what really frightens me is the guy next door who looks like me, walks like me, and ain't.
Oh yeah, and you do one hell of a job with it, because a lot of things you're sitting there reading the thing, and all of a sudden you throw the curveball in, where you know you don't expect anything to happen, and then something happens completely off the cuff, you know, so to speak, that just has you sitting there going, "What the fuck was that?"
Thank you.
And like I say, you don't back away from anything. I mean, you have dead babies, you have cannibalism, you have rape, you have abduction, you have people being, you know, reverting back to their primitive side.
Pete, I also have people falling in love. I have friends. I have friends protecting friends. I start, I guess, from dark stuff, but really, what I'm most interested in is what do we care about? And how much do we care about life, and how much do we care about our own lives and the lives of our friends and our loved ones? And I try to essay that coming from a dark corner. And I think that's really, if I can do that well, then I think I've made a mark that's a little bit different than the run-of-the-mill, you know, slasher horror movie. Not that I have anything problem with any slasher horror movies, but I kind of like to look into the characters first.
Yeah, that's another thing you do really well, is you have such well-developed characters that, you know, the reader actually gives a shit about these people and gets really upset when, some of them get knocked off in various horrible ways, which they'd, you're so good at.
They'd better. Even my vignettes where, you know, you'll meet somebody for five pages and then in the next two pages that person is gone. I hope that I've even, in that vignette, those five pages, I've given you some sense of their value and some sense of their loss when they are gone. I don't believe in body count for my stuff. I can watch it on a screen, enjoy the technical, enjoy, oh, this is how they kill this guy. That's kind of fun. Yeah, it's kind of different and strange and weird. I'm really concerned with, I want to write about us. I want to write you and me and you know, the people we care about.
Yeah, and sometimes, like you say, the worst monster you could think of is living right next door to you, and you don't even know it.
Exactly. Yeah. Every now and then it peers out at you, and you can sort of get a glimpse of it. You don't want to glimpse that too often.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened just up here a few weeks ago. Some guy had a menagerie with, over 60 carnivorous animals.
I know. Yeah. I know, and this bastard should have shot himself before he let the animals loose. I guess, I just was listening to the news tonight, his wife wants to reclaim the ones that are left.
Yeah, the six that survived.
Yeah, I really hope that she doesn't get a goddamn chance.
Jesus Christ. What, you know, my question is, what the hell are you doing with that? 16 Bengal tigers?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The backstory of that will emerge eventually, and we'll figure out what this guy was all about. I imagine if the press bothers to follow up on it, which I hope they do, but often they don't. Yeah. Somebody will to find out what's in this guy's mind. It's an interesting story, God knows, and I'm always interested in animals, because I think that animals are terrific and probably often better than we are, but that's just me.
I'm not into abusing animals. I love animals. This whole thing screwed up my future plans for opening a Komodo dragon ranch up here. I could abscond with that, you know.
One of my ambitions, though, before I drop dead, is I want to see a Komodo dragon in real life, not in a cage. I want to go out. I'm going to go to the Komodo Islands and actually catch one, photograph one in real life, coming at me.
And they will, from what I understand. There's been a couple disappearances down there.
Well, I don't want to disappear. I just want to photograph.
You want to photograph it coming toward you?
I want to see that tongue go out. You know, you ever see those guys, the big long tongue? They're kind of scary.
Yeah, and they're like 15 feet long, too.
Yeah. And the other is, it's a reptile thing, I guess, the Galapagos. I'd love to go see the...
Yeah, that was one of my things when I was a kid. I always wanted to go over there and see, the tortoises, and then these the marine iguanas fascinated me, too.
Yeah.
Someday, you never know.
Hey, we're not dead yet.
I know. Close, but no cigar.
So what are you doing for Halloween, Pete?
I don't know. I'm probably going to hang out. You know, you met Ken at Horror Realm, so we're probably going to go over his house, hang out, watch some movies, you know, do the old school stuff.
Right.
I might take a ride down to the Erie Horror Film Fest this weekend because it's only like 2 hours away down in PA. So, you know, just something to do.
Cool.
Yeah, it ain't like we're doing any conventions anymore. That's for damn sure.
I'm conventioned out for the time being. I guess next year I'll start again. Good.
You still do? What do you do? You do any of the horror conventions, or are you just doing book signings?
No, I do. I've been doing horror find every now and then.
Okay.
At least once a year, I've been basically doing a horror find. Rock and Shock, up in Worcester, Mass. I would have done that this year, but I was at the Sitges Festival this year and couldn't do both. But I'll probably do that next year. I always go to Necon, which is that sort of writers behaving badly convention up in Rhode Island, which is always a lot of fun. Whatever. I'm good with going. My criteria is they've got to pick up my hotel and my plane fare and treat me nicely. And if they do, I'll go. If they treat me not nicely, I don't go back.
Yeah. I should talk to Ken about having you up at Wasteland. You'd have a blast up there.
We could talk about that. I just did... Yeah. For the first time, I just did KillerCon in Las Vegas, and Raph James White treated me really, really well, so I'll go back there and do that next year, probably.
Yeah, some shows are really still good. Other shows have just become, horrible mutations of themselves. It's just autograph shows now.
Well, it's all about how they treat you, I think, and whether they really value your presence there, or whether you're just another body sitting in another booth, sitting next to a bunch of Scream Queens. Not that I don't like Scream Queens. They're
all
and so my best friends are Scream Queens.
Oh, so, yeah.
Over the years, actually, that's been come true.
Oh, yeah. We both know Tiffany, and we've probably known her since she was like 18 years old. So now she's a mom.
I know. God, again, old age.
Yeah. Who would have thought?
I know.
But I agree with you. Rock and Shock really treats people right. I mean, I was helping Sid Haig out that time, and they really give everybody a great time and some soup to nuts, and they really know how to take care of their guests.
That's right. They come around asking if you want a sandwich or you want to because we're manning desks, and it can get tiring. You're on your feet for an 8-hour day sometimes, and they just take care of you. They're really cool.
Yeah, that was a good little show. I don't know if I could do anything up there, but, it was just good seeing all you guys up there and hanging out with Sid and helping him out. So that was a cool show.
Mm-hmm.
And Horror Realm was okay. I think it just has to build itself up,
At this point, I'd rather go with a new show that's hungry and having fun than with an old one that's sort of sitting on its hind legs and saying, I already did this. I've done it. So let's, see what Playboy Bunny we can get in tomorrow.
I know.
I'd much rather do that. I sort of tend to believe that horror fans in general and fans of pulp stuff in general like hungry young people around them. It gives them energy, and it gives us older people energy as well, and it translates really wonderfully. So I'm making friends now and new readers who are in their 20s. That's so cool. That's so amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It's like three generations of people have been reading me already. That's very cool.
Yeah, that's why I sort of like Wasteland, because Ken was on my ass for years to come up there. When I finally did, I just went up as a fan, and I liked it. And then I started doing these panels, and people really, you know, appreciate, you know, what we did in New York. Because, you know, you're from the same era I am. You saw all the crazy shit going on, Times Square, 42nd Street, the grindhouses and stuff. So, you know, they really appreciate that out there, where, you know, sometimes you do a show on the East Coast, it's like, yeah, we know about that. We live around here. Yeah, but you didn't see it when we saw it. That's the whole thing.
I think more people more people in like their 20s now really give a shit about history.
Yeah.
There was a period there where I was meeting people who just didn't seem to really give a damn. But most of the young people I'm meeting now, they not only care about it, but they've done their homework to look into it and see who the old granddads were in the movie business and in the book business. And do they want to read them today? Yeah, often they do. Most often they do.
Yeah, and they have a lot of respect for the genre. Like, you know, unfortunately this year we lost a lot of people. Dave Friedman passed away, and just a couple weeks ago David Hess and Charles Napier and Tura Santana. So a lot of the legendary performers are leaving us, unfortunately.
Sure. But I think that makes us value the ones who are still around, and there is a real sense that this is history, that this actually matters. It's not just fun. It's fun, obviously, yeah. But it actually means something.
Horror
is not just fun. It's an emotion, and it's something we're going to be dealing with for the rest of history. We might as well essay it here and now as best we can in the 21st century.
True. So before we run out of time, what's next on the agenda for you?
Well, I'm missing around a little bit, Pete. I got a couple of short story commitments that I definitely want to do, and I haven't done short stories for a while, so I sort of want to dip it back into that. But Lucky and I are talking about doing another screenplay, so we're thinking about that. We had a really good time collaborating on The Woman, and I'm thinking about another novel, but nothing's really pulled together yet. I've been spending a lot of time promoting The Woman and going to festivals and stuff like that to do that. That's fun, but I need to get back to the desk, and so that's what I'm going to be doing over the next, well, after the holidays.
Yeah, exactly.
The holidays be the holidays, especially this particular holiday for me is both scary season and silly season, because everybody comes out of the woodwork and says, what are you doing? You know, here's going to do an interview, or you want to, like, give me a short story, and it's all lovely, but it's a lot all of a sudden. And so once that's over, and once, you know, once the first 2 years rolls around, then I'm going to get back into the total production mode, so...
Yeah, do you have a website or anything people can contact you on?
I do, yes. http://jackketchum.net. Come by.
Cool, also, yeah, you people should check it out. I'm going to check it out, too. I didn't know you had a website.
I'm also on Facebook and got a Twitter page, so come visit.
Cool. Yeah, that's one thing good about, you know, the information superhighways it used to be called. You can find old friends, you can catch up, and you can see what everybody's doing.
Yep, I try to hit Facebook if I can once a day, and yeah. I'll throw up like quotes from books that I like a lot, and just like try to stir up the brain cells a little bit, so we're thinking about stuff that isn't necessarily horror, has nothing to do sometimes with horror, but just our strange condition in the 21st century. So you know, come by and look at it.
I'll have to find you there. You're under Jack Ketchum, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had to use my real name. They wouldn't put 42nd Street Pete down for some reason. I don't know why. I'm more known by that than anything.
I would think, you know.
Yeah. I'll find you and send you a friend request, and we can, you know, just exchange stupid shit, like, you know.
Yeah, you do it. Absolutely.
I actually got a screenplay tucked away, too. It's just, you know, like everything else, you try, you know, life takes over, unfortunately, and then I, you know, wound up moving up here, so, which has been good, you know,
that's
a lot less stressful than, you know, being in Jersey and all the other bullshit, but I know you're in Manhattan, and that's your turf, and you love it, so God bless, you know?
It's not really stressful anymore. I've got it down. It's like, it's my turf, so it's easy. I think most New Yorkers tend to sort of make their lives easier by taking maybe 10 or 20 blocks tops in a circle, and that's their area. And so I know my area real well. I know my druggist is in the same area. I've known him for years. The guy who does my laundry. We're all old friends by now. It's cool.
Yeah, no, it's nothing like familiarity, rather. But in my case, it was just time. I had to make the move because I just wasn't making the kind of money I need to make to stay in that area. Plus, my parents were getting on, so I had to for once I had to take care of Pete. So that's why I moved out here. And it's I'm not looking back. It's fun. I own the place, so
makes perfect
it's all good.
Sense.
Yeah.
Perfect sense. Yep.
Well, we got to wrap it up. I just got the high sign. We're just about out of time, and I thank you very much for coming on. It was a great interview, and it's going to be a great show, and someday we'll have you back on again whenever you want,
I would love it. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right.
And,
you be well. Happy Halloween, man.
You too. Great having you on, and take care and be good, and keep scaring the shit out of us. That's what we want,
I will do that. All right.
Okay.
Right.
Take care now. Bye. Okay, cool. So that's it. I guess I can go now. Bye now.
Your dreams are all yours right here in the Grindhouse.
So grab yourself a seat on Saturday.